Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable here on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue were joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Tuesday, July 6, Joe and Alan were joined by investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, Tetherless World professor of computer, web, and cognitive sciences at RPI and director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler, and political consultant Libby Post.
A lot of businesses were hit by a ransomware attack, so thank God we have Jim here today. I saw the story and I was like, oh, it's Jim on? Oh, good. Thank God. All right. So 1,500 businesses were swept up in the sophisticated cyber attack, according to the U.S. information technology firm Kaseya, K-A-S-E-Y-A. A hacking group that experts said was behind the sprawling ransomware attack that hit hours before the beginning of the 4th of July weekend is demanding $70 million to unlock the thousands of businesses affected by the hack. The same Russian language group that was behind the attack on meat processor JBS posted the demand on a dark website associated with the group. The group wants the funds in Bitcoin, a popular cryptocurrency, and said if it receives the money, it will publish a decryptor key or a computer code that will unlock the victim's files. The attack was carried out through software that helps businesses manage their computer systems. Kaseya sells its tool to many large managed service providers who in turn help small and mid-sized businesses monitor and control their computer needs. So my understanding is most of these are businesses, small businesses primarily?
A lot of mix, small and medium, yeah. So the thing that's different about this attack, so normal ransomware, the kind we've been hearing about for the past few months and have been going on for a long time, you get into a single computer system. Then you kind of slip through, we call it lateral motion. So you move through to other computers in that same network until you can control a lot of things. And then you suddenly encrypt stuff and shut things down, make it so that people can't get to their own information. And at that point, people have only two choices. If they've been doing a good job of backing up and keeping their stuff clean, they can rebuild their system. Otherwise, they pay the ransom. And tends to be very sophisticated. This one is a scary attack because it's different. What they did is they broke into a piece of software that many people were using. So in other words, they didn't have to break into your computer.
Wow, right.
You brought it with you when you brought this software in. And there were vulnerabilities known. The company was working on them, as the company said. The hackers discovered it a few days before they did, which is what we call a zero-day attack. So it was a very widespread attack because now it's everybody using that software suddenly has parts of their management software they can't get to.
So sorry for being slow on this, but when you say zero-day attack, from the beginning of the thought of we are going to go after this company to the time where this is by the attackers, from the time that they say we're going to go after this company, these computers, these companies, to the time that it happens is about how long?
So it really depends very much on the situation. What we do know is from when somebody gets into the computer to when the ransomware attack is normally about 4 or 5 days. So you have some time to find it. 0 day is a technical term that means it was in the software before you even got it on your computer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, for example, if something gets into
the
Microsoft
operating system. By the way, I like when you use technical terms.
Yes,
that's good.
I'm defining it.
Make the show.
It's like if you get into the Microsoft operating system, right, and had some attack in there, that would be called a 0 day attack if Microsoft didn't fix it before the attackers. Anyway, so this one, the part that's very interesting about it is because of that attack method, they can't ask each individual entity to pay, right? It's like, you know, we break into a whole bunch of cars, we got to get GM to pay, not the car owners, because because once they send this key out to fix it, everyone gets fixed.
Right.
It's not individualized. There's some we
but
think.
But once they send it out, can it be easily hacked again?
Not necessarily, because they'll fix that hole. So generally, ransomware only works once. The company typically then rebuilds things in a new way. Doesn't mean you couldn't be attacked again, but it's sort of like having your kid kidnapped. They're typically, once you get the kid back, it's a different world.
I know you just answered this, but so when it comes to paying the $70 million, do all those companies have to be in on it, or is it just the provider?
It's really unclear. I think what they're talking about at the moment is trying to get all these different companies, and these are around the world. There were companies in New Zealand shut down. There were companies in Australia, England, yeah. Australia, the U.S. We don't even know about some of Europe yet. So I think what they're hoping is the companies will all kick in a little, or they'll all put pressure on Kaseya to do it.
Wow.
All right, Jim, a couple letters from people wondering what they can do or questions about ransomware. So unless, and I apologize, I'm assuming the rest of the panel would not like to answer these questions.
You are correct. You are correct.
If I'm wrong in that and you want to jump in, please be my guest.
I stay in my lane.
Yes, okay.
Hey, I didn't talk much about the condos.
Yeah, right. I stay in my lane.
So John says, why can't computers be configured not to allow encryption?
So part of the reason why many people can deal with some of these ransomware attacks and things like that is because we have encryption. So in other words, if you break into my computer system and I've kept my files encrypted, you can't see my information. Problem is, I have to know the encryption code. So if you can somehow break in and change my code, make it. So it's a two-edged sword. If we don't encrypt the files, it's easier for people to steal the information or do things with change the information. But if we do encrypt it, and if someone else can encrypt it, then we're in trouble. So it's really not so much the encryption that's the challenge. It's the it's keeping people out. And usually these things are coming in through what are called social attacks, phishing, people opening wrong kind of email, people going someplace on the web they really shouldn't go and
right.
saying
do
yes
not
when it asks
open
to download.
An email if you don't know who it's from and don't click on the links.
And they are getting more and more sophisticated.
Yes,
it's
they
like
are.
Really interesting.
They make it look like they're coming from Bank of America or whatever, and you really have to go and look at the email address. And then even that, I've gotten some stuff from people where the email address was hijacked. You know, they had the right URL at the end of the email address. And I write to these people and I said, I think you've been hacked.
And I mean, there's a lot of this going on. And it's very sophisticated. And it depends how they're what we call the attack surface. Are they coming in for a specific machine? Are they trying to get into lots of machines? There's just a lot going on. And the reason is because, you know, think about it as the early days of automobiles. Lots and lots of cars out there. People hadn't yet figured out locks, hadn't yet figured out police protections, hadn't figured out the insurance stuff. So I think we're going to see over the next few years a big change in how we approach a lot of this stuff and a realization that we can't just sit around assuming the government and the big tech companies are going to fix it. But on the other hand, we need those guys to do more doing, and then we need people to really understand what the threats are. So, for example, if ransomware really isn't something an individual has to worry about much, it's a business attack typically. So if they made it so I can't get the pictures of my kids off my computer, that's sort of frustrating, but it's not like it's going to be worth $50 million. Right, but make it so my company can't function and very different things happen. So again, a lot of this is still very much working its way through. It's a fairly new and sophisticated thing that people are trying to figure out what to do with about.
Well, that's a good lead in. So how do we do it? I mean, what do we do?
So as individuals, really the two things that are most important is back up your computer. Right. You save your photos. So if I've got my photos on a disk somewhere and somebody makes it so my computer screws up my photos, I just throw them out and put the old ones back. Right. Maybe lose the same thing with anything else. So as an individual,
is the cloud
it's
a good
easy.
Option?
Cloud's another good option. Cloud, you know, sort of if I'm using, for example, a mail service right now, I don't have to protect my mail. They will. And they'll also do spam filtering and try to remove things.
Right.
Stuff like that. So again, it's a trade-off. And of course, if somebody breaks into the cloud, then they can get lots of people. But it's much harder because those guys have real security. But the other thing is, as annoying as it is, the two-factor authentication, as we call it, when you try to log in on your computer to have your phone. Everybody hates it. It turns out that is absolutely the best thing you can do to keep
Okay,
hackers
I'll buy.
Out,
what
ransomware,
is it?
Et cetera.
What is it?
So it's when you go to log into your computer, a little code comes to your telephone and says, you know, type these numbers, or, you know, there's different ways it works. But essentially, you have to have your phone and your computer to log into your computer.
Yeah, all the fundraising software is like that now.
Banks all do that.
And the reason it's so important, the reason that's so important is, okay, if somebody breaks into my computer, they haven't also broken into my phone. Right, and I've got my phone. Furthermore, if my phone beeps and says, hey, somebody's trying to log into your account, I'm like, wait a minute, what's going on?
So
it's given me a signal. So if somebody breaks into my computer, helps my phone, computer. So these two-factor thing, even if they're both on the same machine, very important. And I hate them too, but I use them everywhere because you need to. That's what really makes it safe.
All right. Oliver writes, ransomware is yet another reason why remote electronic voting should not be allowed.
Yep.
You agree.
Well, so not so much ransomware. I actually have authored or co-authored some policy pieces and been quoted in newspapers. Online voting for critical elections really is not yet ready for prime time. Mm-hmm. We just don't know how to, I could go into a very long spiel about it, which I won't, but suffice to say, it's not even just the security problems. It's how do you keep privacy in there? How do you keep, you know, I mean, imagine what the fraud conversation would be in this last election if not only were we trying to, you know, the Arizona people doing this insanity over, you know, whether there's bamboo in the in the votes, but in the ballots. But imagine if they were doing, is there Chinese characters somewhere deep in the code or something? I mean, you know, it would be crazy. So, yeah, I mean, the bottom line, we're not ready for online voting for major things. For your small organization, for something where it's not critical, maybe. Yeah. And it's frustrating because, for example, in the New York recount, right, if that could have been done online, we'd already have all of that, but the absentees.
But they didn't even crunch the numbers in a computer?
Well, they do, but you got to put them in.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Right,
okay.
That's the time-consuming thing. Is you open the absentee ballot, you make sure it's okay.
You know, that keeps people employed at the Board of Elections.
And of course, with the relatives.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, what's really interesting is that the ranked choice is taking months because, like, we do ranked choice on our computer, and it's like you push the button and it says, okay, here's the winner.
See, that's what I was saying, that so this explains something, because I earlier said, why isn't there technology that would just do the calculations and the recalculations as the voting changes?
Well, it does, but they have to open
them
up.
You have to put it in, the input is.
And now there's 125,000 absentee ballots.
Exactly.
Apparently today's the day.
Yeah.
Denise says, maybe I missed something, but I don't remember ever hearing that any Chinese companies have been hit with ransomware attacks. Maybe that's because the hackers fear Chinese retaliation a lot more than they do America.
What newspaper or outlet would print that if it were?
Yeah, I think the answer is we don't know. Yeah. I mean, the you know, you also don't hear about Russian cyber attacks, and yet we know Revel and some of these others started there and actually did things there before they went international.
We do know that.
We believe that, yeah. I mean, there have been attacks all over the world. And, you know, some countries do better than others. Of course, the more authoritarian you are, the more you control all that stuff, the harder it is for people to do random kind of things.
This letter from Kimberly about the documentary Zero Days. The documentary is about the U.S. government's attack on Iran's nuclear program by hacking into their centrifuges, causing them to destroy themselves. I wonder what other hacking our government is doing.
If I knew, I couldn't tell you. I used to know some of that stuff. But suffice to say that every country is working on how to do this in the kind of military situation. The real question becomes the interaction between civilian and military. So the new the acting director of CISA, which is the part of DHS responsible for cyber infrastructure, was saying how, you know, people were saying, you know, should we be scared about the electrical system and all that stuff? And his answer is, you know, that's not really what other countries are trying to break in for. They would shut us down if we were mobilizing for war or for something like that. That, you know, it's really much more this criminal activity and this cyber activity that we really need to get a handle on.
Vincent writes, why can't companies completely segregate their email system from the company's operation systems?
They can, but the problem is So if I want to be able to attach a file to an email, if I want to be able to authenticate users of my email and connect them to authenticating their access to other things, then I have to connect things. You know, somebody once asked me, you know, can't we just get rid of all the computers and go back to doing stuff on paper? And the answer is yes, and the productivity will go back to what it was before we started using these things. And, you know, you can't play games on your phone anymore. You're going to have to actually go and find a phone booth and pay the ransom. Put some money
in. Yeah. Be good for the
post office. The problem is these things are all trade-offs, and we're sort of in a space where things have been moving very fast to make things more interconnected, not moving quite as fast to protect them. But the only real protection is to turn this stuff off. So what we really need to do is find a fair medium. Again, we do this all the time in our lives. We know where to walk at night and where not to. We know, you know, when do you put a lock on your house versus when do you buy a security system versus, mm-hmm. you know, when do you hire an armed guard? That depends mm-hmm. on what's inside, things mm-hmm. like that. And so I think once we learn to think about computers that way and figure out what's our job, what's the government's job, what's the computer company's job, and also what are, you know, who can we do what to? So, you know, I'm obviously a large Interpol international effort is going to try to find these REVIL people. But, you know, again, it's like any organized crime syndicate.
If they're agents of some state, it's going to be a
Well, if
difficult.
They're agents of state. But, you know, look at the link between Italy and, you know, the crime families,
mm-hmm.
right, that have been traditionally coming out of the Sicilian part of the world. The I'm being very careful because I know this will get letters if I'm not careful. But seriously, that kind of organized crime spread throughout the world. So it went from there, from the local to the international, but also pockets of and things like that. But you can say, you know, is Italy exporting that? The answer is no. But at the same time, there were plenty of examples of where people in the government turned a blank, you know, looked away or got bribed. Same thing we've been talking about with the condo inspectors, mm-hmm. right? The problem is all of this stuff is still dependent on good people doing good things and bad people not doing bad things. So it's learning to live with it is going to be more complicated than I think a lot of people realize.
Let's go to this letter from David Banks. Give you completely contradictory information. They tell you not to click on links that you didn't request, and at the same time, they send you a constant stream of emails encouraging you to click on links that aren't connected to their marketing.
My favorite story on this is there was a lot of companies are now trying to train people. So they send you these phishing emails from, and if you click on it, you know, you get in trouble. You can actually, you know, some of them you'll get fired, you get penalized, things like that if you do it too often. But when you get, when, if you click on one, you get a message that says, you just clicked on a company, click here to see your responsibilities and how to fix it. And we're sitting there going like, what a great phishing attack. We're just going to send the one that says, click here. Again, people just don't think about all this and how to do it.
I keep falling for the one that's for send here for your free keto or something else, pills, and you'll lose weight while you sleep as I try to get ready for a son's wedding. I've twice now had to get new credit cards. I did it. I'm so stupid. Yes. I know. I am aware of these things and still did it. Hope springs eternal.
Rosemary Armeo on the Roundtable Panel on Tuesday, July 6th. We'll be back with more Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Wednesday, July 7th, Joe Donahue and Alan Chartok once again welcomed Rosemary Armeo, this time along with Cohoes City Director of Operations Teresa Bourgeois and Times Union columnist Chris Churchill.
The Associated Press late yesterday called the Democratic primary for Mr. Adams, who solidified his lead over Catherine Garcia and Maya Wiley after the New York City Board of Elections released additional results on Tuesday evening. Eric Adams, the Brooklyn Borough president, ran as a blue-collar New Yorker, certainly with a law and order background. Garcia is seeking additional clarity on the votes. Is that a recount or not quite?
It means he's suspicious.
Yes, wants to know a little bit more. Wiley has criticized election officials. And meanwhile, what we know now is that we have a Democratic, seemingly we have a Democratic candidate who will be running against the Republican, Curtis Sliwa, in the fall election.
Read that. What happened to Giuliani? Wasn't he running also?
He's running for governor.
Oh, for governor.
He's running for governor. Yeah.
And mayor's too small for him. He's going big.
No, that's the big Lee Zeldin, right. Giuliani. Right.
What a fight!
Primaries fight that we get to look forward to.
So what's going on here? Obviously, is that he is the beneficiary, and I said this yesterday, of the fact that people are scared walking the streets of New York right now and think that that they could get done in. And here's a former police captain. But he gets it both ways because he's not only a former police captain, but he was a sort of reformer from within the police. He wins, won that way, I think. I think if things weren't so tough in terms of the way things have worked out, he might not have won. But people are really worried about their safety.
Chris Churchill.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think it shows the kind of resonance of crime as a political issue. I think you saw the same sort of thing with Governor Cuomo yesterday announcing that he's declaring a state of emergency on guns. I mean, it is an issue that people are concerned about, especially in cities, And I think, one of the interesting things about the Eric Adams race is, and maybe this is something the panel can talk about, is was this a success for ranked choice voting, or was it a kind of a dud for ranked choice voting?
How do you tell?
Well, a part of me thinks that if we had had a runoff election between Eric Adams and Maya Wiley, that would have been a really interesting contest, and it kind of ranked choice voting kind of took that away.
Yeah.
You would have had a progressive against a former police captain, and it would have been an interesting debate about the future of New York, and it would have been, I think, something people really paid attention to. But we didn't get that.
Yeah.
Good point.
Rosemary?
I don't know much about this race, and I'm watching it with interest. I think that he, you mentioned this, Alan, has a double sword here. He won because he supposedly knows more than the other candidates about how to make the city safe. Now he has to make that city safe. And I don't think what's going on has anything to do with what he learned being a police captain in New York. So good luck on that. And I question whether he has the chops to be what he is now, which is a national politician. He's going to be up against Cuomo in the state that unhinged de Blasio for a long time. And he has a really complex and difficult city to manage. And yes, I am acting as if he's going to win because I don't think Curtis really has a chance. So get that out of the way.
Yeah, we'll get those letters. What do you think his relationship will be? Teresa, I want to get to you, obviously, right. But what do you think the relationship will be with the governor?
It depends on whether he obeys Cuomo or not.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think Cuomo...
Do you think the die's been set yet?
I don't know, Rosemary. I think I may disagree with you here, because I think I know Andrew well enough to know that if somebody's not him, they're no good.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's that simple.
He goes in. I think that's true. Like anybody who's going to go into an important relationship with Andrew Cuomo starts off at a disadvantage. Yeah. He has to win him over. And I'm not seeing this Brooklyn police captain having a lot of patience with that.
Yeah.
Teresa?
Well, I don't know a lot about the race or about him, but from what I have learned, the fact that he was, as a police officer, an African-American police officer, did stand up against the what he considered injustices within the police department and did that in effective way shows some strength of character and will and desire and focus, which will be necessary as a leader in New York, in New York City. So I think that, that's a good sign. But I also think that if you look at Governor Cuomo's announcement yesterday on gun violence, they both need each other to succeed in those initiatives, right? And they do need to work together. Absolutely. So I think that the timing of that announcement is interesting. I think that they do, and certainly Adams brings the background, the combination of public policy governing experience with his, you know, street experience as a police officer. He understands the issues, and frankly, Andrew Cuomo is going to need him to succeed on this gun violence issue as much as he's going to need the governor. So, but I also, a couple of other things about the election itself. I think the fact that the voter turnout was 26% is really discouraging. We're talking about a lot about democracy in this country and about all the complex assaults on our democracy, but when only 26% of the voters turn out in such a critical election at a critical time in our history, that's pretty discouraging. On the positive side, separate from him, I did see that it looks like for the first time ever, a majority of the city council will be women. Mm-hmm. And so that's, for me, that's a, oh boy, that's a change in a tide, right, turning to have that majority of women. So I think that's a pretty interesting aspect of the outcome of the race.
I was just looking at this when we were talking about seeking additional clarity. So what that means, apparently, is that though the results have not been officially certified, both Ms. Wiley and Ms. Garcia have not yet conceded, and they. But it's Ms. Garcia who is the closest, although it's still 8,426 votes. And she said that the campaign spokesperson said that they were currently seeking additional clarity on the number of ballots, but made it clear that she and her team were committed to supporting the Democratic nominee. So it seems like they're just trying to count everything up before they...
Yeah, you want to make sure you actually lost before you concede.
Right.
Yeah.
Al Gore.
There is that.
Yeah. All right. So the other big issue, of course, then, is the state of emergency in New York State, which many of you alluded to just a moment ago. And what came out of the governor's office yesterday, it is he has declared a gun violence emergency in the state. He has allocated $139 million to address shootings that are rising even as the pandemic recedes and to create jobs for young people. This came out yesterday. The emergency disaster declaration, which the governor said was the first by a state to address gun violence, would allow New York officials to quickly coordinate resources and provide funding for community-led efforts to prevent and respond to shootings. The governor called gun violence a civil rights injustice that overwhelmingly affects poor Black and Latino communities whose youth are 3 to 10 times as likely as whites to be victims of gun violence. But the governor said the issue is urgent for all New Yorkers because the state cannot rebound from the pandemic without addressing it. Alan.
Well, yeah. This is, you know, I always think of riding up to Albany one time on the train, and there was a legislator sitting in front of me. I've told this story too many times. And his assistant was sitting next to him, and he was reading the paper, and he saw something, and he ripped out the article in the paper, and he said to his assistant, "Get me one of these." In other words, write me a bill on one of these. So Cuomo knows how to follow what's going on, and he's right. People are very concerned about crime, and so now we have a crime fighter.
Chris?
Yeah, I like the state of, I mean, I don't agree with Cuomo on a lot of things, but I do like the state of emergency declaration. I mean, I mean, the devil may be in the details, and we'll see what actually comes out of it, but it's good that somebody's at least putting kind of a stamp of this is important on this issue. I mean, in Albany, we've seen, you know, children killed this year, more than once,
right.
Teenagers. If that's not an emergency for your state, I don't really know what is. When people are dying, innocent people are being killed on the streets as they walk to work or walk home from school. You know, I think the part about jobs is interesting because we hear a lot about how there are so many jobs right now that are just not can't be filled.
Correct.
So maybe it's just a mismatch of geography where people, the jobs aren't where these kids are. And, you know, maybe there's a way to kind of link them somehow.
Right. But, to shepherd them to those posts.
What about motivation? Does that bother you at all?
Well, I want to talk
Cuomo's
about
motivation.
Yeah, Cuomo's motivation.
Well, yeah, there is a political side to it. I mean, he's you know, I think what didn't you would know this better than I would.
But I didn't know well enough who was running for mayor and governor.
But didn't Pataki use crime to kind of to in his victory over Andrew's father? Wasn't that one of the issues that he ran on?
Yes, it was. Well, the death penalty was the main one.
So I bent the knee to him, as they say in Game of Thrones, to Cuomo when I read about this. I think it's a brilliant move. It definitely is something that has it's necessary. It's visceral. It's like, hey, that's pretty cool. It immediately taps into his book, which is the source of his biggest weakness right now. He's saying, my management style works, and now I'm going to use it again, and I'll show you. I think it's really bold. It's a statement that he is not for the Second Amendment. He's already hated upstate because of the SAFE Act, and now he's doubling down on that. It's almost Trumpian on the left, and it shows he is a formidable contender and why, even though he's got how many scandals now, I've lost count, he's still
quite a few.
Quite a few, yeah. He still is a contender for national, if not state politics.
I'm struck by what you said about Trumpian on the left. I've been thinking about that a lot lately.
What does that mean?
I think he's got some of that. What
it means? You double down when you're called out on something. He's got no. My leadership style, you know, the one I wrote that book on, it works, and now I'm going to show it to you again. That's doubling down. That's Trumpian.
And you also,
it's in the face of people criticizing him for. Or his SAFE Act. There are signs all over upstate with SAFE Act and a slash mark through it. He's saying, okay, now I got more on guns for you. It's Trumpian.
Well, and also, and right now, I mean, isn't that was sort of the playbook after all of the allegations of sexual misconduct that he just kept going.
That's Bill Clinton. That's the Bill Clinton model. And I mean, I'm sure his brother counts on that, too.
I mean, you just move ahead and go. So we look at this emergency declaration from the governor, and the question I have is, will it work?
Well, it depends what you mean by will it work. I mean, you know.
Will we have less gun violence as a result of this? I mean, it's being used to stem gun violence, correct? So the way it would seem to me, the way to see if it is effective is if the numbers go down.
I spent 3 years working on anti-violence, gun violence initiatives in Boston in the late 80s, early 90s. And the mayor, Ray Flynn, was the mayor of Boston at the time, and he took a very comprehensive approach. I was an honor to work for him.
Okay.
But on this topic, he took a very comprehensive approach. Only a small portion of that approach was a lock 'em up, and the vast majority of the approach was job training, skills building, improve the parks so kids have something to do, take back the parks, try to do intervention not with the leaders of the gangs but with the mid and lower level members of the gangs to sort of pull the power away from the gangs, and then focus with the federal government on the influx of guns into the city. And it's been studied over time. I think it was shown to work. It laid the groundwork for a lot of other things. But I think just declaring that gun violence is a public health problem makes a big difference. Focusing attention on the problem makes a difference. Generating a conversation will make a difference better than ignoring it. And better than a 100% lock 'em up strategy. And again, let's go back to the appears to be the incoming mayor of New York City. I think that if they do team up together rather than fight with each other, I think that they together can make a difference.
Rosemary?
Yeah, I can't add to that. I think that's exactly true. I love the research aspect of this under the NRA. Congress went along with it. Not even research, not even academicians looking further out at the effects, the causes, all the triggers, all the many things that we really don't fully know about and gun violence have not been looked at. So if nothing else, if he accomplishes that, he's got to win.
And the trauma that gun violence the trauma caused by gun violence, not just for the person who shot, but all the people who witnessed that, sure. all the people who experienced that, particularly young people, that trauma, research has shown, can be, you know, last a lifetime. And we really need to understand the long-term impact of people living in these neighborhoods where there's constant threat and constant experience of being shot. And, of course, a separate part of gun violence is suicide, which yeah. people don't talk enough about. And a lot of the deaths with guns are death by suicide, and that, too, has to be dealt with. I know that's not the primary focus of this. But the trauma, it's their health consequences associated. They're obvious and less obvious ones that need to be addressed.
You know, I was very struck by the comments that you guys were making about Cuomo and Adams. Now, yes, one could make the argument that there is the possibility of getting along together and that will be seen as a good thing. But there's also traditional Cuomo stuff, which is, terrible things are happening and we have to blame it on the city. as opposed to the state. And that would be a regular Cuomo move. So, Teresa, you look disapproving. I thought maybe
Cuomo loves his foils, and he, for the last 4 years plus, de Blasio and Trump have been great foils for him. You know, he's been able to kind of blame a lot of New York's problems on either the federal government or what's happening in New York City, and It's easy to say that, well, Adams and Cuomo are both moderates, and Adams is one of the few Democrats not to call for Cuomo to resign, so therefore they're going to get along a lot better. But a lot of the fights with de Blasio weren't really about policy so much. They were just kind of this kind of macho.
Yeah, they were silly.
Arm wrestles
had
over
a falling
control
out years ago that they could never get over,
well,
and they needed to get over it.
Well, right. I think it's that they both wanted to be president. There was that also. And so, anybody who stepped into that was going to be in trouble with Cuomo. Hmm.
Yeah, and they both, I tend to side with de Blasio a little bit on some of this stuff, just because I do feel that Cuomo kind of muscles his way into local issues that aren't really the province of the governor.
Interesting.
A mayor of New York City does deserve to make some decisions about his own city. But the other thing to this, too, is that de Blasio was fighting a different Cuomo. Cuomo's a weakened politician
right
now.
True.
Adams is not, will have in the balance. I think Adams will be better off than de Blasio was.
And I think he needs Adams. And also, he does need an enemy. But the enemy was, in the last year, the enemy was COVID, right? And in some cases, for a while, Trump. And now the enemy is the guns, and the enemy is the, gun runners and those others, and he can team up with Adams to work on this.
Point of information. Now that he's declared this emergency, does he get emergency powers again as he had under the COVID crisis?
I was wondering
I don't think so. I mean, the COVID emergency powers were granted by the legislature.
Mm. And they're not about to do that now.
Yeah.
No, he also said it when he gave them back, said he didn't, we would never need them again.
Right. And I think it's just skimming this.
2 weeks later.
Wishful thinking, okay.
Just skimming this, I was wondering about that myself, and I don't have the full answer. Maybe somebody listening does, but I think it allows for information sharing that might otherwise be allowed for. I think that there are, within the list of areas of focus, it allows some more flexibility than might otherwise, but I don't know for sure, so maybe somebody listening can.
And arguably the most significant, sorry to interrupt, Alan, the most significant part of this is the legislation which will allow New Yorkers to sue gun companies, right, for, I forget the...
Right.
But that was happening already. You know, right. He put his signature
Sandy,
on it yesterday.
Sandy Hook has done
right.
It
and that's
started,
that's a very heavy lift, though. But I think some of this other stuff and just focusing on the public health aspects of it and just focusing on the issue itself, talking about engaging people, mm-hmm. engaging the community, will give him a platform, an issue, as Rosemary mm-hmm. was talking about, and then I think a really important one. Mm-hmm. He can, do good for himself.
It's a really
state.
Bold and it's an astute political move.
Rosemary Armeo, and right before her, Teresa Bourgeois, on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, July 7th. Please note as you listen, any given topic's details and facts may have changed or evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday's show, Joe Donahue and Alan Shartok welcome President and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Bruschetti, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Icarius-Kelly, and immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert.
The president in Haiti is killed, and then yesterday, four people were killed in retaliation for not arrested, but killed, correct?
Yeah, there was a shootout between police and military units affiliated or controlled by the Haitian government. And then they apparently had abducted four police officers and held them. And there was a shootout. And four of the assailants or murderers of the president of Haiti, Moïse, were shot dead. And two others arrested, but we don't know anything about them really yet. And
no.
I wonder if we will find out.
It was at his private residence on the outskirts of the capital, Port-au-Prince. The authorities said late Wednesday that they had intercepted, quote, suspected assassins. The police have engaged in a battle with the assailants, according to the police chief. At a news conference noting that the authorities were still in pursuit of some suspects, were pursuing them so that in a gunfight they meet their fate, or in gunfight they die, or we apprehend them. The authorities did not name any of the suspects or cite any evidence linking them to the assassination. Meanwhile, millions of Haitians anxiously huddled around radios and TVs throughout the day, staying off the streets as they try to understand who killed the president. Mm. Talk a little bit about the turbulent situation there.
So, we have to remember about 2 million Haitian diaspora members live in the United States, so people with Haitian heritage, and about 550,000, recent Haitian immigrants live in Florida, so they've been paying very close attention to what's been happening. This particular president was not elected with an overwhelming amount of support. He also remained in power past the time when he should have called for presidential elections. He was called sort of an old school, possibly, dictatorial kind of person. There was a lot of crime, unrest in the country. Just in June alone, some 5,000 people had moved out of their homes to try and get away from gang-related violence. So Haiti itself, unfortunately, was again in a pattern of weakening democratic structures and increasing violence. Now, that may be the background to this particular assassination. While Moïse was not popular, I think Haitian Americans are deeply distraught about what happened, because what they wanted was an election to be called and a democratic process to go forward. And what they find is the exact opposite.
And so what's the U.S. role here, Vera?
Well, first of all, you know, the First Lady of Haiti was flown out to Florida. Right. She's in treatment there. They're trying to save her life.
The shot
children.
In the attack.
Yep, she was shot multiple times. I think they probably brought the children out for their safety, too, who were in the house during the assassination. And now, of course, a major concern is, what are the long-term consequences? Will Haiti once again turn worse? Increasing levels of violence. Will we have, the United States is very concerned about another huge wave of Haitian immigration, of course, you know. So that's the primary concern. And then also, you know, what are the consequences in terms of stabilizing what is left of democracy?
I will say, just very briefly, is that, you know, in obviously in 2010, the United States awarded temporary protected status to Haitians here in the U.S. And in March, I want to say March, no, maybe May. In May, President Biden awarded, you know, he said that he was going to renew the temporary protected status for Haitians. This was something that had run out before under the Trump administration, that they were going to end this. And so I do think that was an indicator that they knew that something wasn't going right in Haiti, that the fact that President Biden was willing to award temporary protected status again to Haitians. And so we've been waiting, immigration attorneys at least have been waiting for the regulations for so they can have some kind of lawful status, not lawful, authorized status in the U.S. So they can work.
Right.
For individuals from Haiti. And so with this happening, I imagine that those regulations will go through a little bit faster. Yeah. But as someone who has Haitian clients, I know that what we do a lot of asylum claims for on their behalf always, always has to do with corruption and the government and what they went through and not feeling safe in their country. And so it has been a constant story that I've heard over the years, unfortunately, out of Haiti.
Haiti has a long history of corruption at the governmental levels, and back, you know, there was Papa Doc Duvalier and his son Baby Doc, and true story, I had two roosters on my farm who were named after them at one point, Papa Doc and Baby Doc, because they were brutal dictators to the other chickens. So, but they have this history of you know, brutality.
It always comes back to farm animals.
It does, yeah. But the U.S. has some responsibility, and we've tacitly supported very corrupt leadership, and the assassination and kidnapping cycle is something that goes back, 50-100 years. It's really unfortunate. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. And, you know, my family has a number of friends who are Haitian who are relocated to Florida, but are always ever hopeful that, you know, there'll be some stability restored. Because it has huge, you know, huge possibilities.
Right.
I'm fascinated. There's a side piece in the story that supposedly one of the reports says that one of the assassins spoke Spanish, and this is supposed to be meaningful somehow. Like it's outsiders.
I can tell you why it's meaningful, because Haiti has a very tough relationship with the Dominican Republic, and Haitians to this day serve in, you know, as domestics and as, in horrific conditions on sugarcane plantations in the Dominican Republic. And Dominicans have carried out multiple, genocidal attacks on Haitian workers in the Dominican Republic. And Haitians do not ever get citizenship in the Dominican Republic. This is a very tough, tough history between those two countries. And so when you speak Spanish, that means they're suggesting that these are possible Dominican assassins.
Interesting.
And, I mean, that's what's behind that suggestion.
And correct me if I'm wrong. Dominica is the only country that shares a land border with Haiti. So and they closed their border. During this incident. And that just shows you the kind of the tension between the two countries.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
Just for anyone who's listening, Haiti is a former French colony, so they speak French.
Yeah.
Well, and Creole.
Creole.
So I want to make two quick recommendations for people interested. Henry Louis Gates wrote one of the best books that has chapters in it. It's called Black in Latin America, fabulous chapter on the Haitian history, American involvement, and Dominican. And also we have a fabulous Haitian-American writer by the name of Edwidge Danticat, who writes fabulous stories about
heritage. Edwidge Danticat.
Yeah. And her, yeah. Her, one of her really interesting books about Papadoc's period is called The Dewbreaker. So I would highly recommend, if you're interested in that particular history, those are fantastic books to read.
Mike says we should look to Haiti to see what the Republican Party has in mind for the U.S. We narrowly avoided a descent into chaos on January 6th. We cannot count on this outcome again. If we value democracy, we will have to maintain it. That from Mike.
Yeah, that's true. The thing that always bothers me when I think about that situation is the how question. How do we maintain it? Because we see them trying to subvert state legislatures so that the Secretary of State can't call an election and all of that. That's what's so scary to me. I think, you know, Trump was always talked about fixing, rigging elections. Is now proving once again that what he accuses of others of doing is what he does himself. And so there's an awful lot of rigging going on. So I'm worried about how we put a stop to that.
Let's go to this story about somewhat related when it comes to Trump. He has filed a lawsuit, and just for the record, everyone in the studio just started shaking their head. Trump files a class action lawsuit targeting Facebook, Twitter, and Google's YouTube over quote-unquote censorship of conservatives. Former President Donald Trump filed a class action suit targeting the companies, escalating his long-running battle with the companies following their suspensions of his accounts. Legal experts and business associations immediately criticized the claims, predicting they had little chance of succeeding in court. But the lawsuits filed in federal district court in Miami raised a series of legal claims that will find favor among Trump's most fervent supporters, who have long argued that the social media companies treat conservative voices unfairly. We're demanding an end to the shadow banning, a stop to the silencing, and a stop to the blacklisting, banishing, and canceling that you know so well, according to Trump. The suits allege that the companies violated Trump's First Amendment rights in suspending his accounts, and argues that Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, which is owned by Google, no longer should be considered private, but a state actor whose actions are constrained by First Amendment restrictions on government limitations of free speech. Traditionally, the First Amendment constrains only government actions, not those of private companies. There's many places we can start on this, but
but we know that it's not a government agency.
Right.
And it's going to get thrown out because of that.
I mean, the former president is well known for filing such lawsuits and having them
dismissed. It'll become a fundraising tool for him, I think. Yeah. It's definitely going to be a fundraising. But I mean, just to be devil's advocate here a little bit, by the way, I think the lawsuit has no shot. But we need to be talking about whether or not, or what constitutes a public forum, because at some point there is a reckoning here. Like, if everyone is getting their information off of Twitter and Facebook, is there some point where there's a blurring of the line? And are the rules that are in place governing the responsibility of website hosters, owners, or whatever, Section 230 or whatever, which is, you know, very old at this point, do we need to be thinking seriously about reforming them and putting something in place that is more reflective of present-day forms of communication? But that being said, I do not think this lawsuit has a shot.
Well, that's interesting enough. There was a Second Circuit case where they found, I think, the Knights of something, I forget what it was, they sued Donald Trump for blocking them on Twitter because they said it was a form of public forum. And the Second Circuit said that's true. It's a form of public forum. He can't block individuals from following him and, you know, commenting, you know, against him under his Twitter page. So there is some litigation going on about that aspect of it. But, you know, I think what happened here is, you know, unfortunately, Trump was unable to, his blogs weren't popular. And he doesn't have his own company that he can, you know, publicize his voice on, because that's the right thing to do if he really wanted to do it. The right thing to do is not to file a lawsuit against Twitter and Facebook and say they're state actors. We all know that's not the case. So like you said, I think that's a fundraising tool and a response to his failure to be able to get his voice out there like he wants to.
And to your point, Heather, if you're using this as a fundraising tool, it, given what we just read, could be quite successful given how his supporters feel those conservative voices being silenced.
There's a lot of I dislike or hating going on against some of these big tech companies on both sides of the aisle. There's antitrust, legislation being contemplated. The companies haven't necessarily done themselves a huge amount of favors, how they have responded to some criticism. So I do, there's a lot to be worked out here. I don't think this is going to be, the starting point of working out how do we handle people putting misinformation up on Facebook or Twitter, because that really is at the core of it, right? Putting out messages that are potentially dangerous or misleading. What responsibility does the web host or whatever you want to call it, like Facebook, what responsibility do they have for the content? I mean, there's a lot of complexity that needs to be discussed. But again, I don't think the lawsuit is going to be the starting point of those discussions.
And, I always say, we always chuckle because we still watch the YouTube videos when Mark was down at Congress trying to answer questions. I don't know if our Congress is, they have the words or the knowledge to have that conversation.
I love that you're on a first name basis with Mark Zuckerberg. Good for you.
Mark and I, we were chatting the other day.
Mark is down in the district talking to those
boys. I know all the tech giants.
Yeah. But, the idea of conservative voices being silenced, let's just talk about that for a second. Because, and I know this is going to sound flip, but if you say they're silenced, okay. But the reason in this case they're being silenced is because it's nutty, right? I mean, it doesn't seem to be rooted in any fact or reality. And so if a conservative voice said, I feel that we should do this, 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 and this, having to do with the tax code or deficit spending or whatever the case may be, okay, that's fine. But if you start talking about, taking over the Capitol or whatever the case may be, then that becomes dangerous. I mean, that isn't so much a silencing a conservative voice. That is great concern over inaccurate information getting out that can be extremely harmful.
True, but there's a lot of nutty stuff that's on there that is not conservative. Nutty stuff that is potentially dangerous that is not
Absolutely.
Conservative, that does not get shut off. Kids doing stupid things, with soda and Pop Rocks but things that could be dangerous.
That was a great reference. Isn't that how Mikey died? Didn't
right,
hear that,
that
one
is
a long
how,
time ago?
What I heard.
Urban legend debunked. But
my point is their argument is that you're singling us out, even if it's they're not going to admit that their stuff is nutty, right?
No.
But they're saying you're looking at just one subset of people and you're saying we're going to shut you off, but we're not going to shut you off over here who want to have a rally around some other issue that could potentially lead to looting and violence. And you're not shutting off those conversations. You're just shutting off our conversations. And therefore it is selective.
Right.
Now, the argument back is it's private sector. You can be as selective as you want. You can shut off, just your cousin that you can't stand. You shut him off and nobody else. But that's where I was saying.
By the way, how did you know I did that? No,
it's becoming a gray area. I'm not saying that there aren't the really valid reasons to shut them off. I'm just saying their argument is you're only shutting us off. You're not shutting anyone else off, and therefore, our rights are being violated in some way. In order for that to be true, though, it would have to be a public forum. Mm-hmm. And I do think that we're going to have some discussions about that because it is sort of a quasi-public forum in some respects. And there's no fact-checking, which makes it even worse.
Heather Bruschetti on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, July 8th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening. Thank you.